This is the Behavior Research and Therapy Podcast, where we highlight recent research findings and theoretical viewpoints in experimental psychopathology.
Okay, welcome to this episode of the BRAD Podcast. I'm Gloria Gomez, a doctoral student in clinical psychology at UCLA.
I'm Daniel Saravia, also a doctoral student in clinical psychology at UCLA.
On today's episode, we have the incredible honor to talk with Dr. Ron Rappay. Dr. Ron Rappay is a distinguished professor of psychology at Macquarie University and the founding director of the Center for Emotional Health. Dr. Rappay is an expert in anxiety, depressive, and other internalizing disorders across the lifespan. Over the course of his career, Dr. Rappay's research has focused on understanding the development, prevention, and treatment of internalizing disorders, especially in children and adolescents. To that end, Dr. Rappay has developed a number of empirically supported treatment programs that are used globally. His signature program, Cool Kids, is currently used in over 25 countries and has helped a number of youth since its development. Lastly, Dr. Rappay has been honored with awards from multiple organizations, including the Distinguished Career Award from the Australian Association for CBT and the Distinguished Contribution to Science Award from the Australian Psychological Society. He was awarded a member of the Order of Australia in 2012 for his various contributions to clinical psychology, particularly among young people.
Once again, thank you, Dr. Rappay, for joining us. Really looking forward to this conversation. So the first question I'm going to start off with is, what inspired you to devote your career to researching and serving youth and their families?
Well, lovely to be here, and thanks very much for inviting me, Daniel and Gloria, and good morning for me, good evening, afternoon for you. Look, what got me involved, I guess, as long as I can remember as a young boy, and probably very much due to my mother's influence, I've always just had this fascination for what makes people tick. I remember as a young boy sitting in cafes with my mother, and she would just point to a random person and say, what do you think they're feeling or thinking? And what do you think that she wouldn't say feeling? What do you think they're thinking? And well, what do you think happens to them at home, or what do they do for a living? And I just always had this sense of, I wonder what goes on inside people's heads and what makes them tick. So that very much moved me in the direction of psychology, and my early work was very clearly and firmly in the direction of psychopathology, understanding processes underlying mental health, and particularly working with adults. And then it was really a sort of serendipitous meeting that I had together with a very good friend and colleague of mine, Mark Dadds, who many people would know, who is a very well-known researcher in the field of oppositional and conduct disorders in children. And I was doing my work at that time in anxiety with adults. And we were having a chat about our work and almost simultaneously stopped and looked at each other and said, gee, I wonder whether children get anxious. And at that stage, there was very, very little research around. There was a little bit of work by people like Tom Ollendick and Neville King at the time. Phil Kendall was just starting to do some early cognitive work. There really wasn't a lot around. And so that's really what then got me into the direction of working more with children and adolescents, and started a whole direction of work with young people.
That's really cool. It sounds like there was a lot of, you shifted from adolescents or adults to children, and it seems like you were kind of a pioneer in that field. It's really awesome to hear your trajectory.
As I say, there were certainly some great pioneers ahead of my time, and I was able to build on that work as we all do. But I guess as for a lot of us, a lot of our careers is about luck and about finding the right spot and just seeing an opportunity. And as I say, at the time, it was very much that the idea of children being anxious was not thought of as a very common thing in the public, among the lay public. It wasn't seen as something that would happen to children. Your child was thought of as a very happy, lucky, carefree time. Mm-hmm. But the idea of children having anxiety disorders wasn't widely thought of. And that was reflected then in the research world, where there certainly wasn't the explosion of research that there has been now for the last 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, I just like building off of Daniel's point, I think that's super fascinating. And I think related to that, the fact that there was a dearth of research on anxiety disorders in youth, there was probably also a lack of evidence-based interventions for these populations. And it seems like a lot of your work was devoted to devising some of those different evidence-based treatments. So we're curious to learning more of what inspired you to develop novel mental health interventions for youth and families, as opposed to maybe refining existing evidence-based treatments or frameworks, like, you know, just building off of CBT. And I know this is, you know, sort of related to that, but why did you decide to develop Cool Kids specifically?
Right. Well, I don't really necessarily see those as either or options. I like to think that all the research that I've done with, you know, in the applied field, we're developing programs, developing treatments, has always been based on good solid theory and a good sense of trying to understand some of the underlying processes and how we can alter those. And I certainly had that background previously with work that I'd done in the very early days with panic disorder, where I had come up with some theoretical models of the development of panic disorder or the maintenance of panic disorder. And of course, you know, many others had done the same, David Clark in particular, but I had my own version of that. And I used that to develop treatments for panic disorder in adults. So I'd always had that sense of trying to, again, going back to my mother, I guess, that sense of what makes people tick, and then can we use that what makes people tick idea to decide how do we change that or how do we alter that? So it wasn't very different in the child area. Mm-hmm. Again, there was a bit of serendipity in that right around the time that we first started, my dads and I first started talking about whether children do get anxious and then how would you intervene and what would you do there. It was right around that time that Phil Kendall published his pioneering study about the CBT treatment for anxious kids. So we were able to take that and go, oh, okay, there is a model here. There is a basis. And Phil was incredibly generous in those days and shared his manuals with us very happily. And then we happily took those and twisted them to our own methods. Originally, as a sort of Australian translation, so from Coping Cat, we developed what we call Coping Koala, which was an Australianized version of that. But then at around the same time, I also started putting together what I thought of as theoretical models of the development of child anxiety. Where does it come from? What makes a certain child become anxious versus another child not? And so in turn, that did help twist or adjust the early Coping Koala manual into slightly different directions. And so the development of Cool Kids came very much from both the early empirical work of Phil Kendall, but then also theoretical additions to that.
Yeah, I think that's super important that you're kind of reminding us that it's so important to think of the basic science and using some of those insights from basic science to inform the treatments that we create. And I also love this idea that you took something that, you know, another researcher had piloted and tested and trying to build off of that and not just, you know, build from the ground up sort of thing. So I find that super interesting.
Yeah. And I was going to say, it sounds very much like, you know, you saw what was working based off of some sort of template, some sort of model. You also talked about kind of thinking about where these anxiety disorders kind of arise from. So I'm just curious about that in terms of like, mechanisms, right, of anxiety. Do you think there are certain mechanisms implicated in anxiety disorder that we are not targeting sufficiently or perhaps overlooking in our interventions for youth and their families?
Yeah, look, that's a really good question. And I think when Gloria was just saying then, summarizing what I said, and I was thinking that's one of the difficulties or problems these days is that we haven't really developed our theories of models of understanding of child anxiety terribly much. And so the sorts of ideas we had 20, 25 years ago about the processes that underpin anxiety in children I don't think we have a lot that's new, terribly different or terribly new to that these days. And so as a result, our treatments are also stagnating. And I'm not the only one to have said that. I think quite a number of people, both in the pharmacology area and the cognitive behavioral area, have said that our treatment results are not any better now than they were 20, 30 years ago. And the treatments we have these days are not very different. And we come up with these sort of new terms and we sort of say, oh, now I'm doing this twist and that twist. But they're really minor tweaks and variations to the same basic principle. In many ways, they're really the same sort of treatment that people were still using decades ago. And we haven't really, field hasn't really yet moved on to a point where we've got something truly new and different. So as to mechanisms we haven't targeted, or we're not targeting, I can't think of terribly many, largely because I say the theories have not developed terribly much, and there's nothing very much that we've identified. Some of the work that I did recently in the adolescent sphere has started to look a little bit more at external social influences, much of which was not something we had previously talked about with child anxiety. So the impact of peers, the impact of social media and social comparisons, things like that. Now, that is very much an adolescent thing, more than a child thing, and may well be involved. And our treatments at the moment mostly are not tending to address those more external social sort of factors. So perhaps that could be one direction that that may hold some fruit. But again, as I say, we haven't really got anything that we've discovered in the last few decades where we say, aha, this is really critical to child anxiety, and we haven't addressed that in our treatments. We've got things that we think maybe this, maybe that, and perhaps they will improve, they will produce some minor improvements, but not a lot.
Yeah, thank you. So, it sounds like there's been a lot of work that's been done, but there's still a lot of work that needs to continue to be done, and things that we probably need to kind of emphasize in the research that we're doing with this population. Thank you so much for that.
Yeah, I think so. I think there are. I think it's waiting for people to try to come up with something really novel and different, and hopefully that will cause a breakthrough. There have been a couple of possibilities, and I've certainly gotten excited about a couple of things a number of years ago that looked like they might be the next big thing and really different. One of those is D-cycloserine, which people jumped on at one stage as a medication that could actually increase the impact and effectiveness of exposure-based treatments. Mm-hmm. And when that was first talked about, it sounded like, wow, this is the next big thing. Finally, we can combine cognitive processes and learning processes with central nervous system and pharmacological processes to actually produce stronger and better, dramatically stronger and better effects. Now, as we all know, that hasn't worked out, and that's bad luck, but at least there was an excitement that maybe here's something really different and a new direction. Similarly, with the cognitive bias training that people were doing for a while, and I think still are, this idea that, oh, we could actually train people through computers to have a more fundamental automatic shift of their attentional biases away from threat, and that will be a brand new direction, will augment our treatments, take them light years further ahead. Well, none of that, again, has worked out as it happens. They have some tiny effects, but haven't moved the process light years ahead. But again, that was an exciting opportunity. And so eventually one of these exciting opportunities will take hold. And I think that that's the sort of thing that I'm hoping that you young people, not me, hopefully be able to come up with.
Yeah, no, I hear that frustration. I think Daniel and I are very interested in, intervention science, but also how we can implement interventions at a wider scale. But it also sounds like we need to still make these interventions efficacious and identify what mechanisms are important. So I love all the points that you were making. And, on a related note, we know that there is indeed this mental health crisis globally that we see in youth. And this has especially been exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. And I'm wondering, what do you think the field should be prioritizing in the next few years to be able to address this crisis? And especially given all the points that you've already made.
Yeah, look, I think what you've said then is a really good point, and we haven't, I haven't been addressing that so far in this chat, is that where the world has made great strides in the last decade or so has been in the dissemination and accessibility of treatments. So no question, the move of treatments, of good empirically validated treatments onto online formats has been a huge breakthrough. It's not a it's not a brilliant new innovation. It's just a, it's a logical shift that has suddenly opened up treatment accessibility to thousands of millions of kids potentially around the world who wouldn't have otherwise had that access. So that is definitely a large breakthrough. And then public health modeling models, thinking outside the box, step care types of models, and the sort of work that's been done in the UK in particular with low intensity, low level dissemination with a different workforce. Those are huge changes to our public health system that do allow much better dissemination than we've had in the past. So that's where the world has moved forward and where a lot of the energy has been. And that's been really wonderful. But I think to some extent that has come at the cost of a loss or a forgetting of the importance of theoretical modelling and improvements in treatments as a result based on good theory. I know in my own country, in Australia, the funding, the public funding now for research grants is very heavily weighted towards applied practical grants. Everyone wants to have consumers and lived experience people involved in the research talking about how to apply it. You've got to have large sections talking about how you're going to apply the work. The work that gets funded tends to be clinical trials and even more public dissemination trials. And I think we're moving very much away from that basic science of understanding what makes people tick in order to improve our treatments. And I do think you need both. You've got to have the balance of both.
No, I 100% agree. And yeah, I hope that, you know, other people that might be listening to us recognize, like, we need to also not lose sight of the basic science and try to really understand the mechanisms of care and how we can have like stronger impacts or like see more of those like efficacious outcomes when we do give treatments to youth, families, and adults. So yeah, thank you for sharing your insights.
Yeah, I was going to also add, I think it's really great that, you know, I consider myself more of an applied researcher. So I really enjoy like the fact that, you know, Australia is kind of moving towards that direction where it's like, what are we going to do with these findings? Like, we want to make it applied. We want to bring in the community, which is great. But like you mentioned, right, like the basic science still has to be foundational to the research that we do, because we don't want to produce treatments or, you know, interventions that are not going to necessarily work, right? So I think it's just bringing it back to the middle. And I think sometimes we're on one side or the other, but it's about bringing it back to the middle. So that's good progress, but hopefully we can reel it back a bit to the basic science. And something you mentioned, you were mentioning a lot of about dissemination, right? And many of us know there's dissemination implementation, right? That's kind of framework. Which strategies have you implemented in your research to enhance treatment engagement and buy-in from community stakeholders? Based on your experiences, what recommendations do you have for researchers and intervention and implementation science?
It's a broad question. I guess one thing that springs to mind is the inclusion of people with lived experience. While I, a minute ago, you know, made a comment about how that's not necessary in some things, I think including people with lived experience in research when you're talking about implementation is critically important. And I think that move, that's a relatively recent move in Australia, I think probably around the world, is a good one. Reminding us of the importance of the end user and ensuring that our products, which is what they are going to be of interest and acceptable and accessible to the end user. And so including the end user in the research from the outset when it comes to implementation research, I think is fantastic. I think sometimes the problem with grant funding is that they then start to bring in these blanket rules that say we've got to have lived experience in every grant. And, you know, you put in some grant looking at cellular mechanisms or something, you're not going to have it. It doesn't make sense to have them included there, but the government says that's what you have to do. But I think for implementation types of projects, I think that's been a really fabulous direction. And I think I've now forgotten the rest of what was the rest of your question.
The second part to that was based on your experience, right? Because you use the cool kits. Like, what recommendations do you have for researchers in intervention and implementation science? So those that want to, you know, kind of follow your same footsteps.
Yeah, look, I think there's been a few things with cool kits that have been useful that probably have helped its popularity and dissemination. I think one of those has been thinking about the end user, not the lived experience end user, but the professional end user. And so we have ensured that we had a lot of we have manuals that have been informed by people, by professionals who use the manuals, and particularly the way in which the manuals are structured and written. We've had a lot of feedback over the years through our workshops, through focus groups, about the ways in which they want to see these things broken down to make it easy to be able to deliver them. And as a result, we've done that with our programs. And I think potentially, I'm not sure, but potentially that has partly underpinned the popularity. I think including an accreditation process, which I say that as someone who within my team, I was the one who was fighting against that. I just thought it was ridiculous to have accreditation when you've already got people who are well-trained. You know, why would you want accreditation? And, you know, it's just going to put a barrier in the way. But I think, in fact, once again, it's been a way in which it's given people, professionals, confidence that they know what they're doing. And while we know that there are a lot of professionals out there who are extremely well-trained and highly trained doctorates or whatever it might be, we know also that there are a lot of different professionals with different levels of qualifications and different levels of confidence. And for those, having good training processes and good accreditation processes in turn helps provide the confidence and helps increase that uptake and that tendency to want to use it. And I think probably the third thing that's been of value to the professionals that in turn has led to uptake has been our willingness to be a little bit flexible with how it's done, while still ensuring that we have the manuals and ensuring that people follow the manuals and follow the general process, and particularly there's underlying address the underlying psychological processes. We do say to professionals that if they want more sessions, fewer sessions, if they want to change around some of the little bits, the order or something like that, a lot of that is okay. And again, I think that allows professionals to feel they have some control, that they can adapt the program to the needs of their individual client, that they are the one in charge, and in turn, I think, helps them pick it up and increases the uptake of the program.
Yeah, it's really great to hear. And again, I'm very much about community-based participatory research. I think it's important to include the stakeholder in every part of the research process. So it's good to know that you're doing that, and also, like, you know, welcoming that feedback. It kind of reminds me of one of my favorite quotes, that we have 2 ears and 1 mouth, so we should probably listen twice as much as we talk. And so I see that in your research, and I really do appreciate that. And hopefully we can kind of think that way as a general field.
Yeah. I think just related to Daniel's point, there's a lot of talk of, you know, trying to include more stakeholders in the work that we do. And of course, that obviously involves building a lot of collaborations and partnerships. So we're curious of, like, what kinds of partnerships, whether it be with community mental health centers or schools, that you've built, you know, throughout your career in Australia.
Yeah, well, I've been very fortunate to have some good, strong connections with our state education department. And we've been doing a lot of work with them. They're people from the education department have often been involved in our advisory committees and have provided a lot of input to the delivery of cool kits. But at the same time, we also have contracts with them to run the program in schools throughout Australia. And as a result, we then also get a lot of feedback and a lot of traction through there. So that's been a very useful and valuable connection. Other than that, I'm on the advisory committee for a large research centre, a centre of excellence in Australia that specialises particularly in implementation science. and working particularly with the lived experience networks. And so I've got good connections through there. And in fact, I'm learning an incredible amount. I'm supposedly on the committee, but I feel like I'm learning a lot more than I'm advising in that context, because they really have a very different view to what I've been brought up with and to what I've known up to now. And it has been very much that stakeholder, particularly lived experience centric perspective, and the idea of thinking about the health context in which your program is going to be working when you're developing the program to ensure that there is it's going to have utility and practicality. So that's been a very nice connection as well. And of course, look, as a psychology professional, I've had connections and worked a lot with health groups, health departments, with public health organisations, and with a number of private practices around Australia. And that's also been incredibly valuable, and has informed a lot of our work.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. I think it's incredibly hard, I think, sometimes being psychologists to sometimes make those connections. So I think it's, at least for me, someone that really hopes to do more community-engaged work, to see that it is totally possible. It is possible to get at those, you know, higher-level systems like the schools, or, you know, partnering with the Center of Excellence. So, you know, commend you for all the efforts that you've made in that. And obviously, you're learning a lot at the Center of Excellence. So seems like you're super occupied, you know, with just your commitments there. But are there any additional partnerships that you're still hoping to build, whether it be with certain communities globally or within Australia, that maybe have been historically underserved in intervention science?
Yeah, I think first, just going back to your comment about, I think you're quite right, as psychologists, we often struggle a little bit to make those connections. And I think there are other professions, particularly the medical professions, that are much better schooled in doing that and are much better at making those connections than we are. And I do remember many years ago when I didn't have connections, I was a nice isolated ivory tower academic working in my little lab and doing my own thing, and people talking about how you've got to make those connections, and if you want big grants and if you want to, you know, have relevant research, you've got to have the community connections and even the interdisciplinary collaborations. And I remember just being terrified and thinking, oh, if I call them, you know, they're going to think, what an idiot, they're going to think he wants something, they're going to, you know, they're not going to want me to connect with me. And by forcing myself to do it, what I discovered is that most people that you speak to and that you reach out to are so flattered that you want to work with them and are so thrilled to be asked, even if they don't want to do it or they can't do it, they'll just politely say no. But they are usually bending over backwards to do so. And so I think, yeah, if there are any listeners out there, you know, who are feeling very much like, oh, I'm just a, you know, person, yeah, a young academic or a young researcher, and I don't have the connection, reach out, because people are usually very, very happy to connect. Mm-hmm. And so going on to your question, yes, I think making those connections, having those collaborations is more important and more important these days, and is really useful, as we've been saying all the way through this conversation, in terms of making sure that your work is socially relevant. And so in that sense, I think connecting with lived experience groups, consumer groups, is very useful. That's of direct relevance to your field. In my case, anxiety, I've been probably for, I think, the last 15 years, I've been on a committee for the New South Wales Anxiety Disorders Association. It's called Way Ahead, is the professional, is their popular name, but it's essentially, within my state, it's the group of representatives and advocates for people with lived experience of anxiety disorders. And so working with them and connecting with them, of course, gives me a voice into my work, which is extremely valuable. And I listen in on their meetings and regularly hear about the needs and the focus of people with lived experience of anxiety. So those sort of connections are very useful. I think an area where I'm currently, I've been trying to get some work happening for the last 5-6 years now, but it's been proving quite difficult, but I think would be really important, is to be working very hard to try to get representation from the more difficult to access populations in our society. And by definition, they're difficult to access. It makes it hard. But I've been working particularly, trying to work particularly with research with low socioeconomic background people. When we look at the research in anxiety, the clinical trials done for anxiety in kids, 99.9% of the work is done with upper-class, educated, high-functioning background people. And so people from low socioeconomic background, people who are from vulnerable backgrounds, are not represented in most of our research. And so we pat ourselves on the back saying, wow, look at me, isn't it? What great clinical trials. Look at the great effects I'm getting. And we don't know whether it actually works with the most vulnerable groups. And so making connections with those groups and getting into those communities and having input from those communities into the research, I think, is something which is currently lacking in certainly in the anxiety field at the moment and possibly in some other fields.
Yeah, you know, I hear that it's definitely difficult maybe to reach those communities in Australia. And I think for Daniel and I, we've also had challenges maybe tapping in with more like historically marginalized communities in the United States. So I think it's something that we're seeing globally and it's not just specific to one country. And, you know, I hope that over time we are better able to identify good recruitment strategies and engagement strategies that can bring those people in, because I agree. I think, you know, we're not being super representative with our intervention work, and yeah, just like a lot more needs to change, and curious to see, you know, what the next 15 years will show in terms of, you know, who is able to come up with like really good techniques or strategies to bring those people into our doors.
One of my PhD students has just finished a study, a qualitative study, where she accessed people with at the lowest, I think it's the lowest 20% income levels, with parents with children, and the work was looking at getting their opinions on what are the barriers to accessing mental health services, and what are the sorts of things that might change that could reduce those barriers. And I think that those sorts of directions is probably going to be, as you say, in the next 10, 15 years, where people need to move to work out what are the barriers and what's wrong with our current services that is just not appealing to people of particular marginalized background groups.
Mm-hmm. I think what you mentioned, right? Sometimes just doing the groundwork and just reaching out to communities and just seeing it, what their level of interest is, right? Because sometimes I don't think we understand that. Yes, they say no, they're so interested, but they might have a lot of things going on, right? Like, especially these communities that are funded through government fundings. And so it's really nice sometimes to just put on ourselves, put the onus on us and try to see what we can do, right? So I'm glad, because I always wonder, like, are people doing this kind of research? Are people really understand the importance of community engagement? And it's really great to hear that Australia is kind of a pioneer in that, and that, you know, I think some of that stuff is going to start trickling down here in the States. So I'm really glad to hear that's going on. I did want to kind of go back to what we were talking about a couple minutes ago about, right, you were mentioning the importance of lived experience, having people in lived experiences, also when you're working with clinicians, right? Or providers, you know, seemingly like treatments being adaptive, like, you know, do you need more sessions, less sessions? So given that there's, you know, an abundance of evidence-based treatments for childhood anxiety disorders, what guidelines should clinicians follow in choosing one protocol over another for a particular client?
Yeah, if you're talking about childhood anxiety specifically, then I'm not sure there's a lot of guidelines or there's a lot of choice of protocols. In other words, I think the majority of programs out there, and of course, you know, I love to talk about Cool Kids because that's my program and I love to see how successful it's been, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm the very first to admit that the basic principles that we cover in Cool Kids is no different to the principles, of course, in Coping Cat, because it comes from there, but also the principles of many other programs that are now out there for child anxiety. And so I think where they're cognitive behavioral programs, they tend to have very similar sorts of principles, and they tend to have very similar sorts of strategies. And so choosing one protocol over another is probably not going to make a lot of difference when it comes specifically to child anxiety. Where the protocols, of course, do make a difference is for different problems. And so, and that's not something that's particularly novel to say that, you know, naturally where we would choose a different protocol would be based on our assessment and based on the needs of a particular child or adolescent. And in the first instance, that would be diagnostic processes. So where a person, where a child has comorbid anxiety and autism, then you might have a different protocol to where they just have anxiety. Where they have comorbid anxiety and depression, again, you might have a slightly different protocol to where they just have anxiety alone or depression alone. Mm. So choosing the protocol, of course, comes from good assessment and choosing the right protocol for the right situation. But choosing between different protocols for a given disorder or problem, generally most of them tend to have the same sort of effect. And even where they're quite, where they stay, they're quite different. Like, you know, one says I'm an ACT protocol and the other says I'm a CBT protocol, whatever. The outcomes tend to be the same and it really doesn't matter very much.
Yeah, and that probably makes sense, right? Because the underlying theory is pretty much the same for all these kind of treatments, right? So it's kind of like pick and choose, like, yeah.
Yeah, look, I might get some hate mail or some ghosting or something, some horrific input now if I say this, but it goes back to what I made the comment before, that we're, most of our underlying theories are tweaks on basic theory. We haven't with brand new, totally different theories. So when people come up with these different protocols and different strategies, you know, ACT or mindfulness or CBT, they really are fundamentally similar. And if you look at the outcome research, it never surprises me when people say, oh, look, they're the same. Well, of course they're the same because they're pretty much similar. So they're predicting pretty similar underlying processes.
So I'm not one of those people that are going to send you any angry fan mail. I agree with you. I guess just a question, and it's not a question that, you know, we kind of spoke beforehand, but I'm curious, why do you think instead of us developing a new theory, instead of us taking the time to do that, why do we continue to just kind of use, you know, cognitive behavioral theory and just kind of like do minor tweaks? What would be your take on that?
We don't have a better idea, simply. And I'm talking about myself as much as anyone else here. I mean, I think I represent the world here where, you know, believe me, I have tried. I have tried to think about if I think right outside the box, what would be a very different take on this? And I certainly can't. Whether it's whether I'm a slave to my training, perhaps, and my development, perhaps the problem is I can't think outside the box because this is the way I've been trained. Or maybe there is no thinking outside the box. I'm not sure. But certainly I think very few people are able to have very different or alternate views that then in turn hold fruit. So some people do have different, I mean, I've heard some really weird and wacky ideas in my time about possible new treatments or things we could try or whatever that seem totally crazy. And that's all fine if they then work. But the fact is, you know, it seems that the crazy ideas or the ideas outside the box, and I mentioned DCS, I've mentioned attention retraining, both of which come from very strong theoretical bases, so I don't mean crazy, but ideas that are outside the box so far just haven't yet really held fruit. But hopefully someone one day along, somewhere along the way, for me, Steve Jobs of psychology or something, who will come up with something really different. And we'll say, hey, this is a new direction.
Hopefully, right? That's ideally what we would hope that happens in the next few years. I thought about that question a lot, so I'm glad that I was able to ask that, because I'm a proponent of, we probably have new ideas that we're not, you know, pursuing, because I think it's kind of like an echo chamber in a way, right? Like we're all kind of trained in the same way. We're all kind of trained to think in the same way. And so I think it's important, and it's good to hear somebody at your side is saying that, like, it's important to just kind of think outside the box and making it normalizing that, right? So, yeah, I appreciate you having that perspective.
One thing I could say from my recent experience is that we, at our university, universities tend to like to shift the deck chairs around. And so one of the things that my university recently did was they disbanded all of our research centres and said, let's form new research centres. And it all seemed like a very silly exercise, except for the fact that one of the things they forced us to do was to have multidisciplinary research centres. And so now for this year, for the first time, I'm now part of this centre that actually has people in it who are from early childhood, people from health economics, people from business studies, people from linguistics, and people from law, and we're all in the one centre, all focused on mental health. And that's been a real challenge to listen to people who just have totally different ways of thinking and totally different backgrounds that they're bringing to it. And it's been hard. And I think that could be one thing, as you're saying, we live in psychology, in particular, we live in an echo chamber, we mix with the same people, we all have the same basic training, and we use the same language. And sometimes doing the hard yards of actually talking to people from totally different backgrounds and trying to really reinterpret what they're saying into my language, but hearing the different ideas they have, could be one way in which we might break out of that echo chamber.
Yeah, and I know you mentioned that you're now part of this more multidisciplinary center, but you were one of the founding directors of the Center for Emotional Health. And I'm just curious if, you know, you feel like the center was ultimately very successful in achieving some of its goals in research translation, implementation, and dissemination.
I think it was. The Center for Emotional Health, as every center, every organization is of a time. And of that time, it was very successful. We had a large number of academics. We brought in large amounts of grant funding and publications. So in terms from the university's perspective, we were successful. We did what we were supposed to do. But I think we also created and produced a lot of good outputs, including a lot of applied products. It was really through the Center for Emotional Health that Cool Kids was developed and extended to the point of implementation, to the broad dissemination that we have talked about, our online platform for the delivery of Cool Kids through the internet was developed as part of the centre and through centre funding. We had other researchers were doing some fabulous work in the area of school bullying, in terms of early childhood attachment. So there was some really great momentum and some great work that was done through the centre, but it's largely finished, and it hasn't finished its time. But it hasn't completely finished, because in many ways it has morphed into a new centre. And it's, as I say, it's now this new centre is much broader and bigger in many ways in being multidisciplinary. But the bones of the Centre for Emotional Health are still there.
Yeah, no, that's very fascinating. And yeah, I was reading a little bit more about the centre, and it does seem like, of course, like overall super successful. So it's great to see that, you know, you were you made invaluable contributions to helping that center thrive, and of course the other scholars that you collaborated with. And I know you said that, you know, it's not entirely finished yet. So I'm curious, you know, what are you still hoping that center might be able to achieve in the next few years?
Well, I think the main bones of the Center for Emotional Health that remain now are the applied product, if you want to call it that bone. So we still have a practicing clinic, which within my state of New South Wales and more broadly across Australia, has a very strong reputation for treating particularly young people, now older people with anxiety, depression, various internalizing problems. And more importantly, what we're hoping to do in the next decade is to continue that that expansion of applied practical programs. So we're really trying to build up especially our online offerings and run our online offerings. One of the things that we have started to do, we hope to really build up, is an online clinic, so more like a standard clinical service, but entirely run online, beginning with the Cool Kids offerings, but expanding perhaps to some other broader offerings. And expanding the Cool Kids work to other protocols, like Daniel was asking before about other protocols for other disorders. Mm-hmm. So we have currently in the works We have a version of Cool Kids for young people who've got unexplained physical symptoms. And so we hope to build that up into an actual product and start to disseminate that. We have another version that just finished the clinical trial recently, which is for children who've been chronically victimized and have anxiety disorders, but also chronic bullying. And we hope to disseminate that. So it's about expanding the breadth of what Cool Kids products are able to address and those protocols to allow people, clinicians, greater choice if they're able to help.
Yeah, no, that's really impressive. I love this idea of doing a more of like an online clinic. And I think some of that work is also kind of being done in UCLA with community college students. So I love seeing that a lot of people are trying to leverage these advances that we've seen in telehealth, that, you know, a lot of it was facilitated by the pandemic. And I'm really hoping that the center is able to really expand and reach, you know, further number of people through its work.
Just one last question. I think you were kind of alluding to, or at least I thought you were alluding to, some of this cultural adaptation. Gloria and I, we're really interested in culture and the intersection of culture and, you know, some of these psychological treatments. So given that Cool Kids program is used in 25 different countries, did the program need to be culturally adapted to be deemed acceptable and effective in these countries?
That's a really good question. And I also have, over the years, over a couple of decades now, I've just done little dabblings with cross-cultural work. I would no way, anyway, pretend to be a cross-cultural researcher. But I've done various studies comparing cultural attitudes to anxiety, depression, and so on. And one of the amazing things that I just keep coming across is how few cross-cultural differences there are when it comes to mental health. We don't tend to find very much difference. There are differences in the way it's talked about, in the language, perhaps in the focus. With some cultures perhaps focusing more on somatic symptoms, some focusing more on emotion. But the basic principles of mental health seem to be much the same. And we found that, or at least anxiety, maybe I should stick to that to be on safer ground. And we found that with respect to the Cool Kids program being run in different countries, that I regularly ask the practitioners who apply Cool Kids in countries from Finland, Denmark, Sweden, through to Turkey, Indonesia, Israel. I mean, there's a whole range of quite disparate cultures where Cool Kids has been run, and I regularly talk to the practitioners there to say, are there things we need to change? Are the principles working? And they all say unanimously, yes, no, nothing needed to be changed. They changed the examples. So there's one famous example. We start talking about exposure to the kids, and we talk about how, you know, you can, we say, imagine that I've got a problem where my friend has invited me to a birthday party at the top of the Sydney Tower. Now, of course, the Sydney Tower doesn't translate terribly well when you're in Japan or you're in Saudi Arabia or wherever. So they changed some of the examples, of course. I remember that we had a technique that was developed in Cool Kids called worry surfing, where the idea was sort of a mindfulness type attitude, allow the worry to wash over you, go with the worry, don't fight it, that sort of idea. And we called it worry surfing. And when the program many years ago was first picked up in, I think it was Nova Scotia or somewhere in Canada, and they got back and said, the kids here just don't quite get the surfing analogy. Can we change it to worry skiing? We said, no problem. So, yeah, there are tweakings of the words you use. But the basic principles are universal, and they seem to apply pretty well across all different cultures.
Yeah, it reminds me of some of the research that, right, Stanley Huey and Antonio Polo have, produced, where it seems like the cultural differences are very minute with children mental health. But it seems like the adaptations are more about the language, the examples, kind of something that's more salient to those communities, those countries, right, to make it a little bit more tangible in people's minds.
That's right. And I think, and as we were saying before, what's critically important in getting accessibility and uptake and implementation is that whatever you're doing resonates with the individual and they can relate to it. And in that sense, getting lived experience input is valuable. Yeah. And that's where, yeah, having the right language, having the right examples, having the right nuance is critically important. But the principles are the same.
And then it sounds like you kind of mentioned it right now, like you had people with lived experiences kind of help you kind of modify the language, it sounds like, for these treatments in a way that made more sense to them.
Well, for that specific bit we're just talking about, cool kids running in other countries, it's actually been the therapists in those countries. Okay. So it's not so lived experience people, but people who work with them, the therapists, giving us the feedback about that. And it's typically done often at the translation stage, where the translations are usually done by practitioners in the country, and they then give us the feedback about, well, this example won't work, or this way of phrasing it won't work, let's try it this way.
Yeah, that's good to always just kind of go back to the stakeholders and always have their input and engagement. I think that's what makes good science great.
So. Yeah.
Well, Dr. Rapay, I know that, we asked all the questions that, we were interested in and asking you, and at least for me, it's been like a pleasure getting to know a little bit more about you and your research. I'm wondering if you have any last remarks before we sort of end for the day.
I don't think so. I think I've probably kept your listeners long enough. But it's been an absolute joy. But the two of you asked some very, very difficult and very interesting questions. And it's been an absolute joy talking to you both.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. It was great hearing from you, and I'm glad we were able to ask you really challenging questions.
Yeah, thank you for your time, Dr.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Behavior Research and Therapy Podcast. This episode was edited by our audio engineer, Lucas Casto, and music was composed by Grant Carey. For more episodes, follow us on Spotify or visit the Behavior Research and Therapy website. Thank you again for listening.